Okay, thanks for letting us get started. Yes, I'm introducing to you Dr. Pancho Crosa, who is a distinguished scientist at CIMIT, leading the biometrics group there, retired, I guess, 2 months ago, difficult to notice. He's been with CIMIT for 27 years, graduate of University of Nebraska and Universidad Autónoma Antonio Narro in Mexico, and is a native of Uruguay, where he got his early education. I'll just pass it right over to you, Pancho.
Many thanks. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I'd like to share with you some of the work we do in, not in genomics, I guess in prediction, basically, because CIMIT started all this some years ago, and I start thinking on this since all this issue of the markers became cheaper and denser. Many of these people are just consultants in CIMIT, except Juan, that was hired. And there are many others that they contribute. Many of these are in the biometric unit. Hector is in the crop system. The Global Maize Program, Gary has been always discussing with us. The wheat people as well. And now the Cornell guys that are struggling with the CIMIT data a lot, I know. Especially Julie. You know, a lot of persons thinking and doing, especially the phenotyping of maize here in Africa on the DTMA and in wheat in Mexico. The task in genomic selection is basically we have SNPs, we have phenotypes, we need to define a learning algorithm, which is a model that will predict the phenotypic or the genetic values. Then we do the prediction, and then we take decisions. This is coming since 2001, and basically was implants. Rex Bernardo had a publication where he applied genomic selection in simulation. Basically, this is... this is a summation of terms. This is linearity. This is the summation of the additive effect of the marker effects. And this is the effect of the alleles or the chromosome or the haplotypes. The challenges are, that the number of markers really overpass the number of the sample size. N is usually much smaller than P. One of the solutions is just they shrink the marker effect. And so all the statistical models that will do that, Bayesian or not Bayesian, will have a place here. And but also we have the problem of the interaction or epistatic effects between QTLs. So this linearity has been really very efficient in the prediction, but we believe that there are a lot of epistatic effects that are very small, and most of the time they are not captured by the model, by the linear model. So the complexity is obvious. We have so many markers here on the X. We need to develop a model that will capture the marker effect, but this also will capture the interaction or the environmental effects that exist when we use the phenotypic data. How many markers, which are the markers, the type of interactions, dominance or epistasis, and how we can incorporate GBAE. Mark already mentioned something on how they deal with the GBAE, because We have the phenotypic data is coming from many, many environments. And if it's possible, we need to do something there. And then we have this toolkit of models. You know, all these, the parametric, the non-parametric, all these complication names, reach, elastic net, lasso. And then we have all the Bayesian, the Bayesian of this model, the reach, Bayes A, Bayes B, Bayesian lasso, Bayesian elastic net. All these models, they use the marker effect, and they are linear by definition. Then we have non-parametric models like the kernels had been already mentioned. We use, or some people, they use the support vector regression and neural networking, and Mark mentioned the random forest. So there are so many models, and we have tried many of these in the CIMIT data. And I will show you some results. But these are the basic, you know, the basic model is that we have a phenotypic mean that is explained by the genotypic effect and by a residual. And then this is the likelihood of why giving the parameters. Okay? And so the statistical models will differ in the type of information and the method used in order to describe this G sub I. We have the pedigree model. In the pedigree model, this is the additive effect. This is the additive effect. In the kinship model, this is the effect of the kinship. Well, this is the molecular marker. We just use the molecular markers as they are, like in any of the Bayesian. Then we can use the markers and the pedigree. We have found that using the markers and the pedigree, you know, we can improve the prediction a little bit. Not much, but something. Then also we have the kernel. This has been a very good model. And we can use also, I didn't show here, the kernel and the additive effects. And the kernels are good because they are very fast. You can use any number of markers. And they are really very good predictors we have found. So now I'd like to show some of the results we have found in CIMIT data, in various CIMIT data. And the accuracy of the models are measured by the genomic estimate breeding value. And we use the cross-validation between the observed and the prediction, or estimate the correlation between the observed and the prediction. And, well, you know, on simulated data, usually the prediction is around 0.85, in animals 0.71, but it depends on the size of the population, it depends on the number of markers. But we have found very important that as the size of the population increases, we can improve the predictability. This is, for example, a typical CIMIT maize data from Africa, from the DTMA project. We did 50 random partition of the data. The data has 300 lines with 55 SNPs. 55,000, 55K. We never say 55,000, we say 55K. But these are the traits, male flowering, female flowering. Here it should be F. Then ASI, grain yield under well water and stress. And these two diseases, GLS and the Turcum. I also add here, a simulated data. This simulated data comes from Zhang 2005 or 7, I don't remember. Where they simulate 121 markers or QTLs, and then they, without any, you know, any other marker, they just put the markers that were with the QTLs. And then they put all combinations, all the two-way interactions of these markers. All these combinations. And then, well, here is the real data. We use a linear model, Bayesian lasso. And here, this is the kernel model. The kernel model, we use the Hilbert space or the neural networking. And these are the correlations we have between the observed and the predicted model. You see here, it's interesting on the simulated data, when we use only the marker effect, the kernel model is better. When we use all the combinations between the two-way combinations of these marker effects, the kernel models, they really collapse. That means that these kernel models are not very good when you have irrelevant information added to the model. Whereas the linear model, it performs well. Then for the real data, the color doesn't mean anything. I put the color just to show that the kernel, it performs a little bit better than the linear, but you see that the difference are not great. The difference are very similar, I should say similar. And for the flowering time, for the diseases, for the two diseases, are, you know, the two correlations are very similar. You see a lot of variability between the combination of the trait and the environment. I will come to the point that Jean-Luc mentioned about the differences between the correlations and how we use the mean. That doesn't mean that all the values are very close to the mean. You know, the 50 partitions, they change a lot. And the variability due to the partition is the dominant in this data set. And here you have, I plot the correlation of the kernel and the correlation of the linear model. And the correlation of the kernel is the white circles, and the correlation of the linear model are the black one. And here we have the 50 times the 21 maize data set. You see that in general there is a great variability on the correlation values, as Jean-Luc mentioned. But most of the time, for each of these 1,051 dots, the kernel was half of the time or more, I would say 60%, 65% of the time superior than the linear for this particular data set in maize. We also using Bayes B, because the Bayes B is a very good model for detecting regions of the chromosome. We detected regions for GLS in chromosome 2. This is very clear here. In chromosome 6, two regions here that apparently they have been reported already. This is for the 55K marker on the data set, on the maize data set. Here we use the sliding window, which is basically we take the variance of a haplotype of three or four markers. This is the CMIT wheat, SAWIT. Well, now I don't know if this is SAWIT. Yeah, this is SAWIT, yeah. With 50 partitions, with 300 wheat lines, 1,700 SNPs, and two traits, days to heading and grain yield. This data comes from Jan Manes, which is a wheat breeder on the rainfed. These are different environments, 1 to 10 for days to heading and grain yield 1 to 7. These are the correlations or the accuracy. We use the linear lasso, the kernel, base B, base A. Most of the time, all the time the kernel was superior. But sometimes not much differences with the linear model, sometimes yes. That means that There is some epistatic, small epistatic effect that are captured by the nonlinear model. This is, for example, in this particular wheat data set in chromosome 3D, 4 days to heading, there was something here, and something here also. For the chromosome 5B, for stem rust, I don't know if there is something here in this place that has been detected by Ravi, because Ravi can smell at least two or three genes, they said, I don't know. And another region right here, using base B always. This is Ed Buckler's data, that the 25 non-populations with 1,100 SNPs, days to anthesis, days to silking, ASI. You know, here there is a lot of additivity in these traits, and they reported that in the publication. But sometimes there was some room for improvement or using a nonlinear model, you know, to capture some small epistatic effects. But the difference between the models are not great. Now, how to incorporate G by E in genomic prediction? I guess that we try to incorporate into a single model elements from modeling G by E that we've been doing, but also models for pedigree and markers that are used in genomics. So we use the two scenarios. We try to predict the performance of new developed genotypes that haven't been tested, never. And then the cross-validation one. This is the cross-validation two, in which some genotypes were included in some sites but not in others, which is, I guess, this is the most normal evaluation scheme that they use. We use this, and then we have these models. I'm sorry for this, but I like to show here that we use the standard, the pedigree model, which is this one here, with AA, then the marker model, or the genomics model, which is this, and then we use both the marker and the pedigree. And then we model the G by E using the factor analytic, which is a very parsimonious model. And we did this for the CB1 and for the CB2. That means the prediction of one line, or not one line, the 10% missing lines that were never tested, and the CB2, which was the 10% that were tested in some sites and not in the other sites. This is using the wheat data. The wheat data, using the historical S-wheat data, has 600 lines evaluated in four environments and genotype with 1,100 darts. These are the genetic correlations, basically. You see either the genetic correlation due to pedigree, the genetic correlation due to markers, and the genetic correlations due to marker and pedigree. You see that the correlation between site 2, 3, and 4 is fairly high, and 3 and 4 is intermediate, whereas the correlation between 1 is 0 or negative, which means 1 is the site that is causing all the G by E. So I guess that what we wanted to show here, or at least the hypothesis, was that if we can borrow information from these sites for the prediction, we might increase the predictability. Whereas we know, and the breeders know very well, and Gary knows very well, that this site that is different is not going to increase the predictability. Because, you know, that this is reasonable. But we wanted to test this. We wanted to test if the correlation between including or modeling this correlation here will increase the predictability or not, using markers of pedigree. This is one result. This is the dark. The dark is the CB1, which is the prediction of new lines that haven't been tested. And CB2 is the prediction of the lines that were tested in some environments, one out of the four. And we did a tenfold cross validation. So these are the models with the pedigree. This is the correlation between all the models, among all the models with the pedigree. The correlation for the CB1 is 0.4, with the pedigree 0.5. Using the markers, the correlation increases a little bit, and using the marker and the pedigree, the correlation goes a little bit up. But here you see there is no much differences between, well, maybe using markers and pedigree as compared only with pedigree. What I'm saying here is, if you want to predict something that you didn't see before in the field, maybe using the markers and the pedigree will increase, or maybe only the markers will increase more the predictability than using only the pedigree. Whereas in the CB2, which is actually the prediction of something that was tested in some environment but not in others, the prediction using both increases a little, up to 0.6. Now, what is this? This shows the model. Well, here I put DD because we model the residual as well as the genetic part. This is when we model the environments using the factor analytic model here and using an structure on the residual. And so this is for the pedigree, this is for the marker, and this is for the pedigree and the marker together. You see that for environment 1, now the dark is the environment 1, there is not much difference if you use, if you model or not model the GBI. When you use marker, the prediction of environment 1, which was the one that stands out as a different environment, increase a little bit using markers and increase even a little bit more when you use marker and pedigree. With the CB2, you get a fairly good increase in the prediction of the site 2, 3, and 4, which are highly correlated, or at the correlation of 0.5, the three sites, you get a good prediction if you model the G by E, and if you model the G by E and add markers and pedigree. So the results of this genomic G by E is the impact of modeling G by E in CB2 is marked in these environments E2, E4, that they were correlated, but not in E1, which was not correlated much. And for the environments E2 and E4, the benefit in the prediction, it comes from borrowing information from different environments. They were highly correlated, but also for using the markers and the pedigree. And for the prediction of E2, maybe modeling the G by E has some effect, but using the markers has a bigger effect. So as a conclusion, the empirical result that we have done, all the analysis shows that in CIMI, the prediction between different models is not as marked as in WEED. In WEED, we have found a very net superiority of the kernel models as compared with the linear model. By the way, this is radial basic function neural networking, even more complicated than the Hilbert space. Simulated data shows that these are the kernel models, they will capture epistatic effect, but non-signal, if we add non-signal to the models or to the data, that non-signal will affect more the kernel models. And models, modeling G by E and adding the pedigree and the molecular markers improves the predictability, at least on the correlated models. You can find some of this information in this genomics in CIMID place that we have there. And many thanks if you have any questions.
Thanks.